Okay, great. Okay, sorry about the delay. Just looking all over for the sheets. Okay, so Parshas Noach. No, thanks. Parshas Noach is bracketed by two apocalypses, by two Armageddons, two moments in which the world is radically altered, two seismic shifts. The well-known beginning of Parshas Noach, the Mabul, and the conclusion, or the almost conclusion, because there's a little mysterious section, maybe we'll talk about it a little bit after, Dor HaFlaga, but the Dor HaFlaga or the Dor HaPlaga. But there's a stark difference between the two, because the Dor HaMabul, which suffers catastrophically, biblically, the flood, their sins are fairly obvious. You're witnessing complete moral shutdown, sexual promiscuity, denying Hashem, theological heresy. Maybe not in this week's parsha, you don't see it directly, but in last week's parsha, the last section's Zebracious, these children of God that fell from heaven and married freely and wantonly and denied God and called people in the name of God. And so you're witnessing a total collapse of the human spirit, a total, total failure of the human experiment, as Torah says in the end of Bereishis, Lo Yadun Baruchi Ba'adav, Hashem says, I can no longer have my spirit reside with man. Man has to now be clipped down to 120 years. So the devastation which is wreaked upon Dor HaMabul is understandable. It's justifiable. Hashem has to reboot reality. Hashem has to restart the world. Choose one person and restart. Fresh new beginning. New creation. What was the sin of the Dor HaFlaga? What was so terrible about building a tower? What was the tower meant to serve as? What was some of the darker motivations and darker impulses that drove this process? Why do Chazal all of a sudden impute to the Dor HaFlaga heresy, challenging Hashem, let's go up to Shemayim? Where did Chazal get it from? It's much, much less obvious than Dor HaMabul. But if you read Dor HaFlaga carefully, you'll be surprised to see how similar Dor HaFlaga may be to our world in ways that the Dor HaMabul may not be. So let's read the Dor HaFlaga carefully. Please look at the sheet that's on your phone. And let's read this honestly. And then only by reading it honestly, you'll be able to unpack some of what happened to that generation. So source number one, Vahi Kol Haaretz Safa Achas Dvarim Achadim. That's very welcome news. One language, one agenda, one program. Contrast this development with thousands of years. Remember, we read Bereishis and Noach in 2 weeks. Bereishis and Noach are about 40% of human history. Keep that in mind. It takes us 2 weeks to read Bereishis and Noach. Avram arrives on the scene around 2000. So Bereishis and Noach is more than a third of human history. Human history so far has been 5,781 years. 2,000 is more than a third, if my math is correct. So for so many thousands, hundreds of years, humanity was cursed. And it's a curse that they invited upon themselves, the curse of leaving Gan Eden, the curse of strife, the curse of hatred, the curse of murder. Cain kills Hevel, and for 7 centuries, Cain's descendants are traumatized by that death and that murder. They're still referring to Cain's descendants as Tuval Cain. And when Lamech kills accidentally, they're horrified. They accuse him of being Cain. Of course, Rashi says his wives don't want to live with him anymore. It's just an accident, work accident. And there's wanton disregard for the sanctity of marriage. There's a lot of warfare. Probably the world is filled with very ferocious beasts. It's a very harsh world, a very grotesque world, a very dark world. And then the capper, the world gets eliminated in floods and deluges and upper heavens and lower waters, and man is eliminated. You've got giants and cross purposes and hostility and wars. And now finally people are joining forces. Instead of battling each other, let's unify. Let's synchronize. Let's find one language, one purpose, one interest. Let's work together. Let's pool our talent. Let's create solidarity and fraternity rather than strife, disunity, discord, subversion. Vayhi kol haaretz safa achas udvarim achadim. And now you're seeing them climb out of the muck of those 2,000 years of cursed human experience, and they're reversing the curse of Cain. What's the curse of Cain? You're a nomad. You can't live in one area. You can't choose where you want to live. You have to live wherever there's grazing land, wherever there's enough pasture land for your goats, for your sheep. These people say, let's remove the curse of Cain. They're traveling intentionally to one location that they've scoped out. They're traveling from Kedem, and they find a valley in the land of Shinar, and that valley is very fertile. They say, let's live there. Not because it's the next mountain over, not because we're nomads. Let's case out a climate and a landscape that we can live in, and it's a valley, and let's travel there. First recorded intentional travel in human history. Until now, travel was out of fright and fear and being chased, and you're a nomad, and the animals are going to kill Cain, and we have to protect ourselves. Now people are concertedly traveling together. They tell each other, Vayimtsu bika be'eretz shina vayeshvu sham. Let's live in this land called Shinar and travel from Kedem, travel from the east. Now keep in mind, when you're traveling from the east, where are you traveling towards? The west. And in Tanakh, when you're traveling west, you're traveling towards Eretz Yisrael. Because all the activity takes place east, Iraq, Syria, Iran, and east. Very little activity in Tanakh, at least in early Tanakh, in Italy, in America, in France. Doesn't take place. So it's all east-loaded, and when you're traveling from the east, you're moving closer to Eretz Yisrael. It's all north, east-loaded, Tanakh. So there's a little whisper here that they're not just traveling to find the land, but they're being drawn to something a little bit more spiritual. Now some really important sign. Va yomru ish el re'ehu. This phrase may seem very prosaic, very commonplace. It's a major milestone in Sefer Bereishis. It's the first time you have constructive, harmonious communication in all of Sefer Bereishis. All the communication between people in Sefer Bereishis until now has been complaining, blaming, anger, killing, deceiving. This is, if you're a psychologist, one day you'll be a psychologist, this is the first healthy communication in all Sefer Bereishis. This is the first time people are being cast as Ish El Re'eh. We love that. V'yaftel Re'echa Kamocha. This is the first time. Vayamru Ish El Re'eh. Collaborative, cooperative, communicative. They're speaking to each other with respect and common purpose. And what are they saying? Key word. This is the key word of this section. Again, these words may seem very, very nondescript. They're key words. Hava. Hava means, let's make a plan. Hava means when I tell you, let's, instead of reacting impetuously and just acting upon instinct or me, hava, let's prepare ourselves. What does Rashi say? Source number base. Hava. Hazminu atzmechem. Let's prepare. Let's think about this. Let's design. Let's orient ourselves. Rashi says, Kol hava lashon hazmanahu, shemechinim atzman umischabrim limelacha. They're preparing themselves for joint work, olietza, for joint design, olamasa, or for joint caring. Hava, right? Let's pick something up together. On my count, 1, 2, 3. Hava's like, on my count. Let's have a meeting. Let's zoom. Let's think about this. Let's plan it. Let's roadmap it. Who's going to do what? It's called coordination. And when you want to be coordinated and synchronized, you have to plan in advance. It's all just a wild rush and a jailbreak, so everyone just go. But if we want to coordinate, we have to assign tasks. We have to establish, is that the water again? We have to assign tasks, we have to establish timing. Hava nilbana Levanim. Let's make bricks. Again, this seems very, very obvious to us. Not so obvious to them. This is the first time that human beings manufacture something. This is the first industrial revolution in the history of man. It may seem very, very rudimentary and very crude, but for them it was just as magnificent and just as revolutionary as steam energy or as... Because bricks aren't natural. And to form bricks, you have to take clay and sand and dirt. And we'll see in a moment what's missing. How do you make bricks from clay and sand and dirt? You're just blowing it. We'll talk about it in a moment. This is the first time that human beings manufacture something more sophisticated from raw materials. Hava nilbana levanim. Now keep in mind, it's important, not just, wow, we've manufactured, but now that you have levanim, you can use those levanim to build a house. And beforehand, what did you use to build a house? Mud, dirt, reeds, thatch. And what happens to mud houses when there's a flood? It dissolves. What happens to brick houses when there's rain? It's stable. So this is an attempt to avert another flood. Obviously, if the flood is going to be a major biblical flood, brick houses won't help you. But your average rain and monsoon, brick houses are a whole lot different. Why do you think in third world countries, when there's rains and hurricanes and monsoons, hundreds of people die, and in New York, it's just a little inconvenient? Because New York has brick and mortar and asphalt and walls and seawalls. And in third world countries, people are living in mud and dirt. So the second there's a monsoon or a mudslide, unfortunately, there's terrible casualties. So let's build bricks. And you'll see what else bricks allow in a moment. We can't talk about that anymore. Hava nilbana levanim. Benisrefa lisrefa. This is the first time human beings are using heat in a productive and creative fashion. Fire. Now, they probably used fire before, but it was to create metal works. Remember in Parshas Bereishis? Who remembers which one of Lamech's sons was a metal worker? Tivolkai. But you don't need a lot of fire. You don't need a furnace. You just need a barbecue. You need a bonfire. Just put the metal in. You're not going to create bricks in a bonfire. You need a furnace. You don't need a fire. You need a furnace. You need a bellows. You need to create large situations where you can place large. I mean, make one brick. You need thousands of bricks. You place them in this large factory, this large furnace. So human beings are learning to harness fire, not just to make a fire or to cook your rabbit or to cook your deer or to make a knife or a plowshare. This is actually human beings making the first factory. This is the first factory in human history. Every factory needs assembly line, coordination, planning, design, heat, source of energy. So they're making bricks and they have a factory. Vatilem halaveinali even, and they use the bricks as stones to build a house with solid foundations. And of course, not just bricks, but mortar, because you can't just build a home of bricks. You need mortar to connect the bricks. So more material being created. New industrial revolution. Hey, we can use bricks and mortar rather than stones and mud and dirt and rocks and thatch and reeds. It's pretty interesting. This sounds like England. No, England voice there. England, 18th century, America. This is industrial revolution. Factories, heat, assembly line, coordination, interchangeable parts. Now that they have bricks, they can build sturdy homes and protect themselves against the flood, but they have to be on the same page. But something else can be built if you have bricks. Who knows what else you can assemble if you have bricks? A city. Why can you have a city if you have bricks? Because if you have bricks, you can build multi-storied homes. You can't really build too much upon a foundation of mud and dirt, because it's just going to dissolve. But if your foundation is bricks, then you can build a second story. And if you can build a second story, you can have population concentration. If everyone's living in thatch houses and reed houses, you have to space them. If you space them at a certain point, your population will be too dispersed to have a concentrated city, to have an urban sprawl. But once you have multi-story buildings, think Manhattan, think Hong Kong, not those numbers, of course, but you can concentrate populations, and concentrating populations creates protection against animals, against the larger space people occupy, the more susceptible they are, the more vulnerable, the more that you can concentrate, you just build a perimeter and you protect people, you build a fortress and protect people. So you don't just have the first factory, you have the first city. And the first city is a product of factory, industrial revolution, common purpose, fraternity, let's all get along, let's build a city of peace and tolerance. Vayamru, hava, oh, there's that word again, hava. Hava, nivne lanu ir. Now we've completely escaped the curse of Cain and the curse of the Mabul, because we have houses which can withstand water, and we have a city where nomads can now congregate and live in a permanent fashion. Hava nivne lanu ir. But we want to beckon people to the city. We need to know where we live. If you're living from mountain to mountain, no one mountain is more important than the other mountain. You just live on whichever mountain has greenery. But if you want to live in the city, how will you know where the city is? How will you see the city? Well, let's build a tower so that you can see the city from afar. And we have the bricks to actually build a tower, because you can't build a tower out of mud. So we have a tower, we have bricks, we have a city, we have common purpose. Hava nivna lanu ir u'migdal v'rasho b'shamayim v'nasa lanu shem pen nafotz al penei kol haaretz. Because we don't want to be scattered like our grandfather Cain was, or our great uncle Cain, whichever family they came from. We want to live together. We want common purpose. We want to live in the Bikkah. What's wrong here? This is great. I'm waiting for the punchline. And because they lived in the city, they killed everyone. That didn't happen. What went wrong? How'd it go sideways? Industrial revolution, science, common purpose, common language, common interests. It's great. Urban planning. Maybe one day you'll be an urban planner. You'll study Migdal Bavel. First urban design. It's great. Building the first modern city. Curse of Cain. Curse of a Mabul. Maybe we can even reverse the curse of Adam. What's wrong? When a Chazal connect this behavior to they rebelled against Hashem, went to war with HaKadosh Baruch, when Hashem had to disperse them. Well, here's the answer. And you know what? I don't even have to give the shiur this year. I've been giving the shiur for 20 years. 2020, reality is giving the shiur. I'll just comment on it. What happens when man becomes too technologically advanced? What happens when man alleviates vulnerability and susceptibility and weakness and frailty? Well, as man becomes more godlike, God becomes more manlike. Or to say it differently, man loses his need for dependency. Human beings are built based on dependency. We're frail, we pass, our lives pass, we're ill, we need. On the other hand, Hashem equipped us with great creativity to control our world, to organize our world, to protect ourselves. And for thousands of years, man was utterly incapable. The great accomplishment of Western civilization based on Greece and based on Rome. The word cosmos in Greek means order. For the first time, skipping ahead thousands of years, for the first time, the Greeks were able to organize and predict their world. It was no longer brontosauruses about to tear them limb from limb. They could predict science, they could predict nature, they could... But what happens when man becomes too empowered and too technological and too confident and too... He no longer needs a God in heaven. What happens after the Mabul? Do you daven harder that the Mabul shouldn't happen again? Or do you say, let's build a tower? And as Chazal say, the tower wasn't just, and here's Chazal translating it, the tower wasn't just for people to see where the city was. But if you take a look at source number, where is it here again? Because I didn't see it before. Where is it here? Source number Dalet. Rashi quotes Devarim Achadim. Amru Achas Li'elef Etafresh Nun Vav Shana. The Mabul happens 1,666 years into history. So they assume that every 1,666 years, the heavens just collapsed. Source number Dalet. Achas Li'elef V'tafresh nun vav shanim harakia mismotet kishem shasa b'me'a mabul bo nasa lo smuchos. The tower wasn't just a tower, it was a support beams for the heavens. Let's support the heavens. Let's prevent the next bubble. Evidently, the shelf life of God's heaven is 1,666 years. Let's just build support beams so the next time it starts to waver and starts to go all jello on us, we'll have strong support beams. Science can solve all of our issues. Science can solve all of our problems. We can create a stable world. We can create a perfect world. And that's the delicate dance that humanity has to balance. On the one hand, Hashem puts us into this world and he wants us to advance it, to perfect it, to propel it, to improve it, to stabilize it, to enhance it. Hashem does not want us living in thatch huts using outhouses. Hashem wants us to improve our condition. For a Jew, the march of science is driven by a religious impulse. Hashem wants us to improve our world. Remember the words I told you 2 weeks ago when we were in Shul, Le'avdo L'shamra. Hashem wants us to advance the world as we preserve the world. There was a book written right before September 11th, 2001, obviously. It was published right afterwards. People thought it was in response to 9/11. It was really not. It was very prescient. The name of the book was written by a Mideasterner called Bernard Lewis, a British historian. And in this book, he poses an interesting question. Three words, you know, everything can be reduced to three words. What went wrong? How did Islam abdicate its cultural, scientific, and technological supremacy, which it had enjoyed for hundreds of years? And evidently, at some point in the last millennia, Western civilization overtook Islam, usurped it, and that's the cause for so much Islamic rage. What happened to our lost honor and our lost glory? How come Crusaders have stolen it? Ruben, can I just, or Jeremy, can you just close the door, man? How come the Crusaders have stolen it from us? So he poses the question from a historical vantage point. I'm a religious thinker. I find myself asking myself that question from a religious standpoint. My God, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Melech Malchei Melachim, is Melech HaRachamim. He's a merciful God. He wants people to have welfare and prosperity. When the world doesn't support that, he wants me to try to improve my world. So for me, the march of science is a religious impulse. Muhammad's God is a God of injustice and a God of anger and a God of vengeance. And if the world is awry with suffering, well, God doesn't mind it so much. And there's no religion. I have to re-landscape my world in the image of my God. I know that Hashem is Rachamim. When I see there's suffering in this world, I want to change the world to bring it more in line with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's interest. So for me, I'm an Eved Hashem. I want to advance science and I want to advance prosperity. I want to change my world. What happens in a religion in which God is angry and full of vile and vengeance? Well, is there any impulse as from a religious standpoint to change your world, to improve your world? There was an American professor and lecturer called Eric Hoffer, 20th century, who captured it in my mind best. He said, before man had the skill to move mountains, he needed the faith to move mountains. What happens when you have too much skill? You lose faith. And human experience is that very delicate dance between equipping yourselves and empowering yourselves, and we don't see technology as demonic or evil or irreligious or satanic. But at certain points, humanity reaches a tipping point where there's just too much technology, too much confidence, too much. And as God fades from view, because human beings become, one could call it self-deification. Not the age of paganism, but the age of self-deification, where human beings are their own gods. We no longer have needs for the gods of heaven. And that's exactly what's happening in this scenario. They're technologically, this is the first technologically, it sounds silly, they have internet, they have planes, but trust me, 200 years now, they look back at us and say, oh, you called yourself technologically advanced. You pour fossil fuel into a tin can to go from one continent to another, that's technologically advanced. I get into my hovercopter and put in a fusion crystal, and I land in Australia in 20 minutes. You have to actually spend, come on, 50 hours on a flight. So don't be too intoxicated with our own technological achievement. We'll be the laughing stock of our descendants, just like our ancestors are our left, a subject of our ridicule. Trust me. These are the people that had created a brave new world of bricks and furnaces and assembly lines and factories and cities and common purposes. And Once you have that common purpose, you don't need Hashem anymore. And once they didn't need Hashem anymore, they built the tower to support the heavens. And say, while we're supporting the heavens, source number, again, I didn't get to see this before, but let me just find the source for you. Source number Gimel, the Medrash says, Amru, line number 3, Lo kol heimenu lavrolos elyon v'litin lenos etachtonim. What, Hashem has the right to choose heaven and give us earth? Earth is unstable. Source number Gimel, Bo, they said, v'nasa lenu migdal. Let's make a tower. V'nasa avod azar barosho. Let's put an avod azar on top of the tower. V'nasa cherev biyada. And we'll put a sword in that avod azar's hand. Is it in Brazil? Is it in Rio de Janeiro, right? Where's the tall statue with the sword? That's not a sword, it's a sheath of wheat. Let's put a tall statue on the mountain overlooking our city. It's like we're making war with Hashem. I don't think they're making war with Hashem, but we're equal to Hashem. We're the Titans. We have support beams. We have our statue on the mountain overlooking the city. We have our own sword. Well, that's the world that we live in. In some ways, the first part of the 20th century more resembled the Dor HaMabul. And the second part of the 20th century more resembled the Dor HaFluga. And now we're trying to climb out of the curse of the Dor HaFluga. When I mean the first part of the 20th century resembled the Dor HaMabul, it wasn't as horrific as the Dor HaMabul, but humanity was struggling with morality. Humanity, hundreds of years earlier, had started to develop alternatives to monarchies. And some of those alternatives abused human liberties, as ironic as it sounds. And democracy had yet to settle into human consciousness. So fascism and communism, and of course the ugliest form of fascism, Nazism, challenged humanity morally. So these were institutionalized Dor HaMabul. They weren't individualized. When we read about Dor HaMabul, we read about two people on the street who swapped wives, or two people on the street who killed each other, two people on the street who stole each other's property. This is a more institutionalized Dor HaMabul. We had systems being instituted by human beings that were abusive, that were immoral. And by 1945, we escaped the Dor HaMabul. But that escape from the Dor HaMabul was so triumphant and so convincing that we thought, well, we've solved all evil. We've crushed communism. We've crushed Nazism. World War II was very intoxicating. It was very euphoric because we harnessed and marshaled all of our resources to defeat the challenge of democracy. And basically, Nazism was a challenge of democracy. Hitler's gamble was that democracies can't be efficient enough to mobilize in time to stop my blitzkrieg. By the time you vote in your parliament to go to war, I'll already own half of Britain. Democracies are weak, and he was right, but thank God at that point history wasn't. We see the weakness of democracies in mobilizing to face issues because we become polarized rather than unified. Everyone knows that in China, it's easier to fight COVID because there are cameras in every corner. And if you leave the house when you're supposed to be in quarantine, you get shot or put into jail. I'm not sure that's a preferable world to live in, but it's easier to handle crisis. Because unity of purpose, central command. We live in a polarized world, and sadly the pandemic is just creating more polarity and more hatred and more aggressiveness. But we have this false belief that big business, technology, this belief that we could solve all problems. And slowly but surely that belief started to erode. Let me tell you when it first eroded. And then when it later eroded. It first eroded in the 80s. What eroded it? AIDS. You can't imagine the euphoria that immunization brought to the human mind. Your grandparents, and certainly your great-grandparents, were victims of a very, very dark microbial world that they couldn't understand, but that they knew wreaked havoc upon them. Your grandparents didn't go to public swimming pools, and not because they were mixed pools, because of polio. Because half of the people they knew were handicapped. Presidents were handicapped because of polio, and smallpox, and chickenpox, and mumps, and measles. And all of a sudden by the 60s, We thought we had control of this world. I remember all the shots, and to me, these were new things. I was going as a child in the 70s, and these were, oh, we just discovered a new shot and a new booster. These were not just normal routine, like, oh, a new booster. All of a sudden, we realized in the 80s that they were viral contagions we just couldn't control. But even more devastating and even more destabilizing was not what happened in the 80s, but what happened on September 11th, because that was a shockwave to the presumed world of safety and security that we thought we could just install and protect. And our governments and our armies and our culture, and obviously our taste of freedom would be so attractive to every single possible culture that second we just offered it to them. But even as we lost some of that confidence, we were still gaining the confidence. And what gave the confidence? Because in 1990s, there was a technological leap forward that even though we suffered through AIDS and we suffered through the loss of faith in government because of scandals in government, Vietnam and the equivalents in other governments, the major difference between 1990 and 2020, 30 years, no new fossil fuels, no new sources of energy, no real discoveries, no new real inventions. Periodic table hasn't really enhanced or enlarged. You know the major, major change? Why the world in 2020 is unrecognizable to the world in 1990? It's called the internet. It's called the capacity to communicate rapidly, efficiently, to share ideas. And the internet is a product of about 400 years of anthropology. How is the internet a product of 400 years of anthropology? It's a product of chips and semiconductor chips. The internet and quick communication would only be possible if there's one common language. Today, the internet exists in every language, but for 10 years, the internet was only in English. The whole substructure of the internet is based on we can all communicate together through one common language. And that common language in 1990 was English. But it was a common language in 1990 because of what happened in 1590, in 1690, in 1790. And that is, of course, the British Empire. The spread of the British Empire through 300 years spread British culture. Sun never sets in the British Empire. It also spread English. After all those hundreds of years in which English was being spread across the world, and of course the United States is a superpower, just reinforced English. Now the grounds were set, literally. Just now read these psukim, but not as Dor HaFlaga, but read them as 1990. Vayehi kol haaretz safa echas u'divarim achadim. They all speak one language. Now that we speak one language, let's pool our resources. Let's celebrate in the shrine of technology. We could just not exchange fire and bricks. We could just exchange ideas and solve all of our problems and consult with Dr. Google and we'll solve any illness and the technology will solve it. That's the curse of Dor HaFlaga. That's the world we live in. And that, of course, is the message of 2020 and the reminder that as technologically advanced as we think we are, we realize the limits and the frailty, and we look to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Even as we are advancing technologically, the message of tonight is not to withdraw from technology and science and just message to persist, but do not get caught up in that world or in that false belief of human invulnerability and human invincibility. How do you straddle a fence between engagement in technology and trying to change your world without self-deification, while still remembering Einod Milvada, without needing harsh reminders such as September 11th, such as AIDS, such as COVID-19? How do you engage, how do you celebrate human ingenuity without deifying humanity? How do you stabilize your world without abdicating vulnerability? That's the challenge for you guys in life. Because you're all going to be involved in that world. You'll be involved in technology. That's who you are. That's who we are. You'll be, I don't see anyone, I don't think anyone in this room is going to be a fireman. You're going to be a fireman. You're 6 years old. You're going to be at the forefront of the new generation, advancing humanity, technology, science, commerce, the sense that I can improve the world. And Hashem wants to improve the world without losing a sense of human fragility, without abdicating that sense, without falling into the rabbit hole of Migdal Babel. And Hashem reminded them how frail they were. And to remind them how frail they were, Hashem didn't have to demolish their tower. Hashem didn't have to shut down their furnaces. Hashem didn't have to raise a flood upon them. All he had to do was alter their language. And it all fell apart like a bunch of dominoes. Hashem played with their language, even unity, which we feel is the greatest asset. The greatest asset is unity, not technology. Technology is a product of unity. When we pool resources and pool ideas, we're going to advance technologically. Corporations, Apple is Apple because there are great minds thinking together. And unity is based on communication, a common purpose. Once we lose common purpose, we lose communication, all the technology falls in on itself, self-immolates. All Hashem had to do was take away some of that unity, and even to play with their unity, to play with their language. They lost their unity, they lost the common interest, they lost technology, they lost synchronization, and they got scattered. So the second message of tonight is, very secondary message is, unity is a great asset. And sadly enough, we're seeing today in the modern world how countries that have unity and purpose are able to deal with viral threats. And countries that don't, it just tears them apart. Sad to me to see some of the polarization in Israel. Baruch Hashem, it hasn't disintegrated to violence, into angry protests. If there are protests, there's different purposes, there's disappointment, hatred, anger, but it's not at the point where it's more institutionalized, political, this party, that party. I get the sense, just as an outsider, again, I haven't been in America in 7 months, I haven't lived in America, but I get the sense when I'm looking at what's happening in America and other parts of the world, there's actually real anger at a person-to-person level. It's like rage and anger, and people meet each other in the parking lot and scream and attack, and there's a lot of personal anger. It's not just political, institutional disagreement. No one in Israel is like beating each other up or killing. It is more just political parties, ideological dissent, which is not justifiable because it can quickly disintegrate or descend into personal hostility. Since we have 3 minutes for an important lesson, okay, and maybe we'll get back to this some other point, but it is Parshas Noach, and you are at the stage that you're trying to become a better person. And one of the ways to become a better person is to think about how you speak. And one of the ways to become a better person to think about how you speak is to avoid trying to curse. Now, people use an inaccurate term to describe cursing. Nibble peh refers to pornography. Certainly not something we're going to talk about in 2 minutes. But when you use words to describe sexual activity, that's nibble peh, that's pornography. Sadly, curse words today have nothing to do with pornography. People do not use curse words to describe pornography. They use curse words as a sad substitute for actual vocabularies. So if you ask me, oh, it was a tasty dinner and an exciting game and a riotous storm. Someone, of course, says it's an effing game and an effing dinner and an effing storm. It's just humiliating more than it is pornographic. It's not nibble peh. It's, as I said before, sad excuse for lack of vocabulary. And also aggressive, angry, ugly language. Most of the curse words, there isn't a curse word. Oh, Abe, you're so handsome. They're about excrement and sexual lack of pedigree. And they're about ugly parts of our world. Most of the curse words are not. Oh, Yaakov, you're a son of a priest. And a lot of people curse. It's not, oh, you're the son of a righteous man, I'm going to curse you out. It's very ugly, aggressive, disgusting language. And Parshas Noach reminds us that it's not just about nibble peh. Remember, the Torah talks about the animals who are tahor. And what's the next part of the pasuk? The animals who are? Doesn't say tamei. Is tamei pornographic? Tamei's not pornographic. Tamei is just not lashon naki. So when you think about improving the way you speak, obviously the first stage is chas v'shalom, not to use any pornographic language. But unfortunately, today's curse words are so commonplace, they have nothing to do with sexuality. When people use the F word, it has nothing to do with sexuality. It's just using curses. You also want to be someone who speaks belashon naki, clean language. You don't want to say tameh. Who knows how the beginning of Maseches Pesachim begins? The night of the 14th, Bedikas Chametz. What's the first word?
Or.
Or normally means day. Sometimes it means night. It takes the Gemara a daf and a half to prove that here it means night. Why not just say Leil Arbaser, Bokin as a Chametz, Leil Arner? What's the big drama? Answer, because this is the Masechta that talks about Geula. Why don't we start with a radiant word rather than a dark word? Or Leil Arbaser. The word Laila is not pornographic. It's not nibble peh. It's just not as elegant as or. David HaMelech begins to hill him backwards. Ashrei Yish Asher Lo Alach Batzaz Hashem V'Vederech Atam Lo Amad Rashalism. It's backwards. Fortunate is the person who doesn't hang out with evil people. What should he say? Cursed is the person who hangs out with evil people. Fortunate is the person who doesn't hang out. It's like scratching your left hand with your right ear. What's the answer? Because David HaMelech doesn't want to begin to hill him with the word Arur. Imagine everyone's micography and all that art on people's dining rooms with Tehillim written out and that first word, Arur. David HaMelech wants to begin to tell them with the first word, Ashrei. It's a nicer way to begin. Learn to speak well. Your tongue is what separates you from animals. Learn to have a big vocabulary. We don't have time to talk about it now. The more words you have, the clearer your thought, the sharper your ideas. Reb Chaim used to say, a chisaron in hasbara is a chisaron in havana. If you can't explain something, probably you don't understand it well. Have a deep vocabulary. Don't use cheap words. Don't use vulgar words. Don't use gutter words and aggressive words. And it's nothing. People say nibble peh, but it's not nice. If you catch it, wait a second. It's not nibble peh. It's using a curse word. Okay, there's good reason not to use those words. My apologies again about the delay, everyone. It's the Marav. Marav.